They're different today. And I'm not going to stand here in front of you in front of this thing. So my leg is hurting me, and it's swollen pretty bad. So instead of standing on it for whatever time, 45, 50 minutes, I'm going to sit.
You're going to have a sermon 10 minutes long?
Well, that's an idea.
I thought you were going to dance.
You might have to adjust that. Okay, so you won't be able to see me as well. That's fine. Mind that. I can still see you guys. So, can you imagine yourself growing up like George Washington Carver? Does anybody here know who George Washington Carver was? Oh, we got a couple of people. None of the young people don't. What do they teach in school these days? Anyway, considering him should make us all appreciate things a little more. Okay? So George Washington Carver was born in 1864 during the Civil War. He was born to a black family. He was a black child, and his family was in slavery in Missouri. His father actually died before he was born. And then when he was 1 year old, his mother and his sister were kidnapped, and they were never seen again in that area. His slave owner, Moses Carver, raised him, at least for a while. His wife, Mrs. Carver, tried to teach him some reading and writing, and she realized what a bright little boy he was, really bright, had a lot of potential. So when he was 10 years old, they sent him to an all-black school, which was about 10 miles away, and back then 10 miles meant you were going to be there, you weren't going to come home. So from that point on, he was on his own. And he went to different schools because a lot of the schools, that they were all black schools. The teachers really didn't have a lot of education themselves. So he actually did chores and worked different little jobs and stuff to for his keep. And he traveled around to different schools. And eventually, he was able to say that he had finished school. And then in 1891, when he was about 27 years old, he had tried to go to college in Kansas. When he showed up at the college in Kansas, they said, oh, you're black. You can't go to our school. So somebody said, well, why don't you try Missouri? So he went over to Missouri, and there was a family there that kind of took him in. And he tried to get in Iowa State University, and they accepted him. He was the first black student at Iowa State, and that was in the 1890s. And he went there. He got his bachelor's degree, and he went on and got his master's degree in agriculture. And he was then hired as the first black professor of Iowa State. So you can see the story. He just kept churning. He kept trying, and things eventually kind of worked out for him. He really appreciated the education. He saw the importance of education, how that was. He was very fascinated with plants and growing things. But then, not long after he was hired at Iowa State, somebody in Tuskegee Institute, which was a poor black school down in Alabama, realized he was the only black person educated in agriculture in the whole country. And they wanted a teacher of agriculture. So they asked him if he would come to Tuskegee. He went to Tuskegee in 1896, and he taught there for 47 years. 47 years. He was a professor there. He taught farming, and he realized that the farming in Alabama was really poor because they had depleted the soils. They had raised cotton year after year after year. They had put no cover crops on. They didn't really have anything to put on the land to give it organic matter. They just wore the soil out. And the poor people were sharecroppers mostly. They just couldn't make a living on that land. So he realized they needed to build up their soil and they needed to change the crop. So he promoted putting organic matter on the soil. He promoted planting legumes so that the nitrogen would go from the air into the soil. He promoted rotating the crops so they didn't have the same crop every year because the cotton had the boll weevil. It was just no way to break the cycle. They planted cotton year after year, and the boll weevil just got stronger year after year. So he really promoted agriculture for the poor people of Alabama. And one thing that he realized was the peanut is a legume. But there was no demand for peanuts. So he was a very good person at experimenting and doing lab work. And he figured out over 100 different foods that you could make out of peanuts, including peanut butter and peanut brittle and peanut candy and all kinds of things you can make out of peanuts. And then he also made dyes out of peanuts. He made other things in manufacturing that you could use peanuts for. And peanuts went from a crop that was hardly ever planted to over 2 million acres by the time he was getting older at Tuskegee. And he also promoted the sweet potato as another crop that was really good, that was good for the soil too. So that was kind of the story of George Washington Carver. I found it was quite an interesting story. He was offered jobs at other places for much more money, and he turned them down. He wanted to help the poor people in his region. And he also was a very devoted believer in God. He really gave God the credit for his success in life and really believed in God. Now, he didn't, and also you could see in the story, he did not have a strong desire for physical possessions. He was very content at his job and his role in life once he got his job at Tuskegee. And so it was a person that both white people and black people have admired. Now, I was recently reading Hebrews chapter 13, verses 5 through 6. And as I was reading that, I thought about George Washington Carver. And I was struck how much he was an example of someone who followed those verses. So today, I want to look, just focus, we're going to go to other verses, but I want to focus in on Hebrews chapter 13, verses 5 through 6. And just focus in on that, those scriptures, and see what we can glean out of these scriptures. So I want to turn over there and read that scripture first. Hebrews chapter 5. It's just kind of just a thought that this is toward the end of the book of Hebrews. Whoever the writer of Hebrews was, we think it was Paul, just put it together. He says, "Let your conduct be without covetousness. Be content with such things as you have. For he himself has said, 'I will never leave you nor forsake you. So we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me? So there's a lot of different thoughts there. There's covetousness, there's contentedness, there is trusting in God, looking to God, realizing God is our helper. It's being bold and brave, not fearing. It's just a lot of different things. And so I do want to try to explain a couple of things. How is not having covetousness related to being content? And how is not being covetous and being content related to the statement that God will never leave us or forsake us? And is it true that God never leaves us or forsakes us? I want to look at that, okay? And also, I want to look at three different people in the Bible that I feel that lived up to these two verses. And they are examples for us. And I'm sure there's other examples. You'll probably think of other people. I thought of some other people myself that had followed these principles. But we'll look at three of them. Okay. So, first, we're going to dig in kind of phrase by phrase. And the first phrase is, let your conduct be without covetousness. Let your conduct be without covetousness. And covetousness involves one of the Ten Commandments. So as Ethan went to the ninth commandment, I'm going to the tenth commandment over in Exodus chapter 20 and verse 7. I think it's the next verse that after his. And just read that verse so we're reminded of it. I think we all know this verse. It says, you shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, nor his male servant, nor his female servant, nor his ox, nor his donkey, nor anything that is your neighbor's. Now, it's not saying it's wrong to have possessions. We all need possessions to function in life, to have businesses, to provide for our family. But it is wrong to covet what your neighbor has. It's definitely wrong to covet what your neighbor has. And covet means to have a strong desire for. It becomes almost an uncontrolled desire. It's an inordinate desire. It's a selfish desire. I mean, the one thing it says here is you should not covet your neighbor's wife. You shouldn't be looking at your neighbor's wife and saying, boy, I'd sooner have her than my wife. That'll get you in trouble in many different ways. But that is wrong. God doesn't want us to covet things that aren't ours, then really we shouldn't have. Now, if the neighbor decides he wants to sell his property to you, then... yeah, that's up to your neighbor, okay? Anyway, coveting involves the mind. And sometimes covetous thoughts just dominate our thinking. That's all we can think about is what we don't have and what we want. And we really need to be careful when that happens. Now, Jesus talked about it some over in Luke chapter 15, Luke chapter 12, verse 15. Jesus said, take heed and beware of covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of things he possesses. Really good advice from Jesus Christ. To take heed and beware. It is something that can creep into our mind and take over. For our life... really, when it gets down to it, what is really important isn't the abundance of things that we possess. I've always said the more you have, the more problems you have, the more things you have to worry about. So anyway, that's what Jesus said. So each of us needs to consider that instruction. And what is our mentality towards physical things and having things that we don't have? We are bombarded in this world with advertising, and certain types of media try to entice us to want to covet what we don't have and what others have. So we just have to be aware that in this society there's pulls towards the wrong things. Now, in Mark, I'm just going to refer to this, Mark chapter 7, verses 20 through 23, Jesus again, he mentions some things that come from within and defile a man. He mentions quite a list of things that come within a man and they defile a man. And one of those things was covetousness. So covetousness can defile us. It comes from within. And we should strive in our conduct to be without covetousness, as it says here in Hebrews chapter 13, verse 5. Let your conduct be without covetousness. So the second phrase here says, be content with such things as you have. And then I want to refer to Luke chapter 3, verse 17. You don't need to go there, but a soldier asked Jesus. I mean, a soldier was kind of convicted. I should follow your ways, okay? And he asked Jesus, what should I do? And Jesus replied, be content with your wages. Be content with your wages. That's all he told him. Evidently, he recognized in this person a need to be content. And so that's something we can ponder on ourselves. Now, I do want to go to 1 Timothy chapter 6. 1 Timothy chapter 6 and 6 through 9. This is some advice from the writer of Timothy. Now, godliness with contentment is great gain. Having contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out. And it is certain that we can carry nothing. And having food and clothing, with these we shall be content. But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare and into many foolish and harmful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. So, great gain. It's great gain. It has great value. Contentment. Of course, godliness too, but my focus today is on contentment. Food and clothing are necessities. They are necessities. Having a place to stay dry and warm are necessities. Okay. But the connection between covetousness and contentment. Covetousness is an indicator that we're not content. That is an indicator that we're not content. We're not happy with the house we have. We're not happy with the wife we have. We're not happy with our workers, whatever. So, when you're covetous, you want what someone else has. And when you are not content, you're upset emotionally. You don't have peace of mind. And when you are content, then you have more of a peace of mind. And when you have peace of mind, it's much easier to be thankful. And, you know, as we celebrate Thanksgiving this coming week, just remember, in order to celebrate Thanksgiving in the right spirit and in the right attitude, it helps for us inside to be content and to be thankful for the little things that we have. You know, just like George Washington Carver was so thankful for his education, he was so thankful for the little plants that he worked with, the little lab tools that they gave him to work with. You know, he going through what he went through makes you appreciate things. Okay, so Philippians chapter 4. I want to turn over there. Philippians chapter 4, verses 11 through 13. Says, not that I speak in regard to need, for I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. I know how to be abased, and I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. So, Paul had learned to be content in whatever state he was in, whatever situation he was in. That allowed him to continue to be positive. That allowed him to continue to be productive in his ministry, in spite of the situations that he was in. It allowed him to be an encourager of others, to do the right things. So, strive to be content with such things that you have, just like it says over in Hebrews chapter 13, verse 5. Now, the next phrase, lost my place there, in Hebrews chapter 13. For he himself has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. So, who is he himself has said? I don't know that Jesus actually said that, but the Bible says that. And Jesus and God the Father inspired the Bible. So we're going to look at where God said he would never leave or forsake you. In the first place I want to go, there's other references. I just want to look at a couple of them. Deuteronomy chapter 31, verse 6. This is right before they were going to go into the promised land. Deuteronomy 31, verse 6. And this was Moses speaking to the people of Israel. He says, be strong and of good courage. Do not fear nor be afraid of them, the people in the land. For the Lord your God, he is the one who goes with you. He will not leave you nor forsake you. That's what Moses told the people. And then he told Joshua the same thing in verse 8. Verse 8, and the Lord, this is speaking to Joshua, the Lord, he is the one who goes before you. He will be with you. He will not leave you nor forsake you. Do not fear nor be dismayed. And this is repeated over in Joshua chapter 1, verse 5. That God will not forsake you or leave you. Something that they could look to God to help them. And then another interesting reference to this is over in 1 Kings chapter 8. 1 Kings chapter 8, and this is Solomon. Yep. And verse 57, 1 Kings 58. And this is a prayer that Solomon was making, and he says, may the Lord our God be with us as he was with our fathers. May he not leave us nor forsake us. You know, I thought of that. You know, he prayed that. That's something we should probably pray, that God would never leave us or forsake us. Because it's, as we're going to see here, it's not totally automatic, okay? Because is God's promise that he would never leave us or forsake us always true? Well, it's over in Deuteronomy chapter 31, verse a little later than the verse that I read. Deuteronomy 31, verse 16. And the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, you will rest with your fathers, and this people will rise and play the harlot with the gods of the foreigners of the land, where they go to be among them, and they will forsake me and break my covenant which I have made with them. Then my anger will be aroused against them in that day, and I will forsake them, and I will hide my face from them, and they shall be devoured, and many evils and troubles shall befall them." That is a warning. He promised earlier in this verse that he would never leave them or forsake them. But if the people left God, if the people leave God, there's no connection anymore. And they're on their own, and things don't turn out good. So, over in 2 Chronicles chapter 15, verse 2, never reference to this, 2 Chronicles chapter 15, verse 2. No, maybe. Okay. So he went out to meet Asa and said to him, "Hear me, Asa, and all Judah and Benjamin. The Lord is with you while you are with him. If you seek him, he will be found by you. But if you forsake him, he will forsake you." And then, chapter 24, verse 20. So I think it's pretty clear, if we forsake God, he will forsake us. Now, it doesn't mean that if we slip up and sin and, you know, make a mistake or something like that, that's not forsaking God. That's being human and messing up, and we need to repent. But if we forsake God, if we cut off our prayers, if we cut off our looking to him for help, if we cut off our belief in him, then there's going to be big problems. Okay, 2 Chronicles chapter 24, verse 20. "And the Spirit of God came upon Zechariah, the son of Jehoiada the priest, who stood above the people and said to them, 'Thus says God, why do you transgress the commandments of the Lord so that you cannot prosper? Because you have forsaken the Lord, he also has forsaken you.'" You know what the people do to him? They stone him to death. They stone the prophet to death. They had forsaken God. What happened to the people? God forsook them. They were taken into captivity and suffered tremendously. So it's a lesson for us. Don't forsake God. So if we don't forsake God, he won't forsake us. And we can be content. We can be content because we know that God will help us in whatever situation we're in. He's there. He hears us. He knows. He knows what's best in the end. It sometimes takes time. But it, like it says, he is our helper over in... So we go to the next part, verse 6. "So we may boldly say, 'The Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me?'" And then this is referring to a couple of verses in Psalms, actually. Psalm chapter 27, And I think that is something we all believe, but it's something we all need to remember. God is our helper. And we need help. We can go in our prayers to God and ask for help. Okay. Psalms 27 and verse 1. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the strength of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? So, like he says at the end of this verse, we don't need to fear. We don't need to worry about our possessions. We're doing the right thing. We're working hard. We have the right attitude. We look to God. God's going to help us. Over in Psalms 118, verses 6 and 7. Okay. The Lord is on my side. I will not fear what man can do to me. The Lord is for me among those who help me. Therefore, I shall see my desire on those who hate me. So sometimes God just provides someone to help you. Sometimes he works different ways. It's usually surprising how he works when we have a real need. But the Lord is on our side. We don't need to fear. It's very comforting to be able to read these scriptures. So, who are the three people that I believe that lived up to these two verses? First person that I thought of was Moses. Moses, the adopted son of Pharaoh's daughter. Over in Hebrews chapter 11, has a very interesting comment about Moses that we would never realize from reading the Old Testament. At least, I don't think so. In verses 24 through 27, it says, by faith, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasure of sin, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt. For he looked to the reward. A lot of interesting things in that passage. When you think about Moses, he was Pharaoh's daughter. At that time, he could have had all kinds of possessions and wealth, power, all the women that he would want. And it tells us here, he gave it all up because of his faith in God. And he looked for a reward. It doesn't tell us, I don't know what reward he was knew about. It doesn't really tell us back in the Old Testament, at least as far as I know. Things were revealed, but somehow he knew about a reward. And he gave all those things up. So it shows us that he was not covetous. He was not covetous. And he believed that he should be one of God's people. And he didn't care if he suffered the reproach of the Egyptians. Because there was many indignities about being an Israelite in Egypt at that time, because the Israelites were slaves. They were treated like slaves, like just worthless property that they would, if they broke down, they just threw them away, And they were just looked upon as just not human, basically. So, I want to look over at Hebrews chapter 2, because when he left Egypt, it tells us the story here in Exodus chapter 2. he saw an Egyptian beating an Israelite, and it wasn't right. And somehow he killed the Egyptian. And then he knew he was really in trouble. So he had to get out of Egypt. And then the story goes to he went to the land of Midian. In verse 21, and Moses was content to live with the man, and the man was Reuel, tells us his name up in verse 18. And Reuel gave Zipporah, his daughter, to Moses. And she bore him a son, and his name was Gershom. For he said, I have been a stranger in a foreign land. But the point here is, Moses was content. He was content. He had a place to live. He had food and clothing. The man gave him a wife. He actually had an adopted family. He was a stranger, but they didn't treat him like he was a slave or something. They treated him with respect. And he had a child. So Moses was not covetous, and he was contented. And he did look to the reward of his father, his God, his helper, who would never leave or forsake him. Moses was faithful those whole 40 years that he was in Midian. He was 40 years, and we don't hear of God interacting with him at all during those 40 years. He stuck with it. He stuck with his religion. He stuck with his belief. He didn't go back to Egypt, at least until God told him to. And then at the end of the 40 years, we know the story, then God really started working with him. Anyway, and we do know the story of Moses. He wrote the first five books of the Bible. God used him in tremendous ways to get the Israelite, help lead the Israelites out of Egypt, try to lead them into the promised land, gave us the commandments. Tremendous, tremendous individual. The second person that I thought kind of lived up to these two verses was Ruth. Ruth. Ruth was a lady who married a Israelite after he had moved to Moab. Ruth was from Moab. And her husband died, and she could have stayed in Moab. She would have probably been better off to have stayed in Moab, found a husband of her own race and religion, somebody that would support her. She could be near her own family. Her prospects were probably very much better if she would have stayed in Moab. Israel was a world that she did not know. Now, her sister-in-law also lost her husband, and she chose to stay in Moab. But Ruth chose to go with her mother-in-law, Naomi, because Naomi wanted to go back to Israel. And we're going to pick up the story over in Ruth chapter 1, verse 16. And really, her mother-in-law, Naomi, tried to talk her out of going with her. You'll be much better off if you just stay here. But Ruth said, entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from following you. For wherever you go, I will go. And wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me and more also, if anything but death parts you and me. So, quite an attitude this young lady had. Her vow of loyalty to her mother-in-law. Her mother-in-law had very little to offer financially. No income, not much of an inheritance. In fact, Ruth was going to need to be the worker and support Naomi and herself. So it could have been said of Ruth, Ruth chose to suffer affliction with the people of God rather than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin in Moab. Notice what Boaz said about her. This was before they became romantically involved, over in chapter 2, verse 11. He just noticed her and saw her behavior. And Boaz answered and said to her, "It has been fully reported to me that all you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, and how you have left your father and your mother in the land of your birth, and have come to a people whom you did not know before. The Lord repay your work, and a full reward be given you by the Lord God of Israel, under whose wings you have come for refuge." He recognized that she was looking to the true God, the God of Israel, for her help. She had a certain amount of faith in that God, but she evidently had been taught maybe by her husband, her mother-in-law. As you read the story about Ruth, it points out here she had come under the wings of God for protection and help, and that, that's kind of how we are. We want to be under the wings of God for our protection and help. And if you notice, she doesn't seem to be covetous. I mean, she was. She could have had much more by staying in Moab. She seems to be content. They had a place to live. She found a place to glean some grain. They seem to be fairly content. As long as they had the food and raiment and shelter, they would be okay. They had each other. And she did look to the God of Israel for her help. And she was blessed of God, over in chapter 4, verse 13. So Boaz actually ended up getting romantic with Ruth. And he took Ruth and she became his wife. And he went into her, and the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. And the women said to Naomi, "Blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without a close relative. May his name be famous in Israel, and may he be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is better to you than seven sons, has borne him." Then Naomi took the child and laid him on her bosom and became a nurse to him. And the neighbor women gave him a name, saying, "There is a son born to Naomi." And they called his name Obed. He is the father of Jesse, who was the father of David. And if you read the genealogy of Jesus Christ in Matthew chapter 1, Ruth is mentioned as the wife of Boaz and the mother of Obed in the genealogy of Jesus Christ. So she was very, very much blessed. Then the third person that I thought of was Jesus. Jesus had tremendous talent and ability. He had great understanding of the scriptures. He could do miracles. He healed many, many people. He provided food for many people miraculously when it was needed. And he was a very good person. He was a great teacher, and he was a leader. He could have been a leader of a city or a region. He could have been a teacher of a university back in those days. He could have been very successful by the world's standards. Instead, he came to fulfill prophecy. And the prophecy I want to look at is Isaiah chapter 53 to remind us of what Jesus did and what he gave. I mean, we can see he had tremendous potential, but he gave it all up for the good of the people of the world. Over in Isaiah chapter 53, verse 3, I'll just read a couple of these verses. This is a prophecy of Jesus. He is despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised, and we did not esteem him. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, stricken by God and afflicted. He was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement for our peace was upon him, and by his stripes we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way. Then the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He was led as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before his shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. So that's just part of what that says. It could have been said of Jesus. Jesus chose to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of passing sin in Israel. Christ wasn't covetous. We never see him having an inordinate desire for the things that other people had. He was content as much as being content was possible at that time. Because he knew that in the end, his Father would not forsake him. Because in the end, he was not forsaken. He was resurrected from the dead. He was able to go to the right hand of the Father. He has an eternal spiritual body, far more valuable than anything that this world had to offer for a few years of fame and wealth. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 4 says that he was rejected by men. But Jesus was brave. He did not fear what man could do to him because he had faith that God was his helper. Moses, Ruth, and Jesus all were wonderful examples of individuals who followed Hebrews chapter 13, verses 5 through 6. And we, really, these verses are for us. We're admonished to follow Hebrews 13, 5 through 6. It's not easy. We have temptations. We have situations. It seems like sometimes God isn't there. Just all kinds of things can happen. It's not easy. I want to read Hebrews 13, 5 through 6. Let your conduct be without covetousness. Be content with such things as you have. For he himself has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. So we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me? So, as we celebrate Thanksgiving, let's strive to do it with a Hebrews 13, verses 5 through 6 attitude.